Morning, everyone. As you can see, and as Joelle said, I am not Sharon Treat. My name is Chris Bostic, and I work for Action on Smoking and Health. Sharon and I have been working on this particular issue for about 3.5 years, so I'm happy to step in and try to do justice to the presentation that she sent me. I want to give you a little bit of background on Sharon. Sharon is an attorney from Maine who also sits on the Maine in the Maine legislature and has for decades worked on public interest issues through both a legal and a legislative lens, and has been instrumental in our campaign to work on the nexus between trade and tobacco, especially in the TPP. I also want to point out that I'm going to be talking strictly about tobacco today and the friction between tobacco control and trade agreements, but a lot of what I'm going to say applies across the board for public interest, public health, environment, labor issues, human rights. There are a lot of issues coming up as the international trade regime grows. I also wanted to say that Sharon has plenty of information. We've been working with the Harrison Institute of Georgetown University Law Center for several years. If anybody is interested in this, we have probably more legal research material than you'll ever want to have. Just see me afterwards. So let me move forward here. Neither Sharon nor I have any relationships to disclose. I also wanted to point out that Sharon was very thorough in her presentation. I know I'm on the clock, so I didn't want to take slides out because I believe these can be downloaded, yes. So there's a lot of information here that I'll kind of fly by, but it'll be there for you if you would like it. I left this slide in as the disclaimer that Sharon put. Sharon sits, she's one of the few people in the public interest field that sits on one of the trade advisory committees, which I'll talk about in a moment, which means that when she gives a presentation like this, she has to be very careful to only talk about things that are publicly available. She's not allowed to ever speak about what goes on in these advisory committees. However, I am not on one of these advisory committees, so I can say anything that I want. So I do not have to have this disclaimer. So Trade Policy 101, I will not be going into the legal aspects of trade policy, but how trade policy is made. And it is different than most legislation you've ever seen in the world. It's behind closed doors. We do have a special office for it. The United States Trade Representative works directly under the White House. He does not work under one of the other executive branch offices. The United States Trade Representative is an ambassador level position, and has to be confirmed by Congress. And one of the things to know about trade policy is that these agreements that we have with other countries are not considered treaties. Under the U.S. Constitution, a treaty has to be ratified by two-thirds of the Senate, which is the reason that we don't ratify very many treaties. It's very difficult to get even 50 senators to agree on something. Getting 67 is almost impossible. So to circumvent that, they don't call these treaties, they call them agreements, which means that a simple majority of both houses of Congress is enough to get them passed. These treaties are treaties. I still call them treaties because, of course, it's an agreement with a foreign government, which in my mind is a treaty, are conducted entirely in secret. The negotiations themselves are held in places that are difficult to get to. We truly have to lobby when we're even able to find out where these negotiations are going on. And by that, I mean we wait in the lobby of the hotels. There are armed guards on the floors of the places where the delegates are actually meeting to make sure that people like me can't even get on that floor to talk to people. So we have to make contact in advance with delegates from various countries and then sort of flag them down as they come down escalators and downstairs. The text of the treaty itself is kept secret, the draft text, even from senators and congressmen. If a senator wants to see the current text of a treaty, they have to make an appointment with the USTR, go downtown, go into a room after having had their cell phone and any notes or pens confiscated. Then they can look at it for as long as they want, but unless they're very good with their photographic memory, they can't go back and report on what's in it. And that's only for them. You and I can't do that. There is a system of these trade advisory committees that the United States government has set up to ostensibly put public input into these treaties. They're almost entirely dominated by industry. As I said, Sharon does sit on one that we'll talk about in a moment that's designed to allow other levels of government to participate, state and local governments. There's also someone from the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids that sits on the Agricultural Policy Advisory Committee. Other than that, it is almost entirely industry that sits inside. And as I said, what goes on in these discussions in these trade advisory committees are secret, and criminal charges can be brought against someone who sits on one and divulges what happens inside. I won't go through the whole slide here, But you can see that this is the industry and committees that they have, and it's all broken down by different areas. And the tobacco industry sits on several of these. Any that they can possibly say relates to their products, they sit on. And this is the one, the IGPAC is the one that Sharon sits on. There are actually very few state or local government officials on these committees. It is again still dominated by industry folks, and there's no public health representation whatsoever on this committee. Just a little bit about the trade network that the United States is involved in. This is just for the U.S. From a global perspective, if you look at the fourth from the bottom there, the BITs, that's the bilateral investment treaties. There are over 3,000 of those in the world right now. It's a web of various investment treaties. We don't know the exact number, not because we haven't bothered to look it up, but because some of those themselves are secret. And we don't know until someone sues whether or not such an agreement even exists between the two governments. So I wanted to ask a question first, since there is another panel going on right now on the TPP. If I say Trans-Pacific Partnership, how many people know what I'm talking about? Oh, good. That was like a quarter of you. But still, three quarters of preaching to the choir doesn't work. So this is good that a lot of you don't know what I'm talking about. If you go to some of the other countries that are involved in it, they do know what we're talking about. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is currently under negotiation. It's between 12 countries that border the Pacific, including the United States. And once it's finished, it will be the largest regional free trade agreement in the world, far bigger than NAFTA. It's nearing completion. We expect that in 2015 it will finally be completed. And this is the treaty that Sharon and I have been working on in particular, because this is being touted by the United States as the model free trade agreement for the 21st century. And so they do intend that the language in this treaty will move to future treaties. There's also the TTIP, which is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. That's not as far along as the TPP. It only started in 2013. These negotiations take many years. This is between the U.S. and the European Union. It, when it's finished, will then become the biggest regional free trade agreement, dwarfing even the TPP when it's completed. And then there's TISA, Trade and Services Agreement. Even compared to the other agreements, this is a shadowy negotiation. They have no official rounds. We never know where they're talking, so we can't even get there to lobby on this one. There have been very few leaks in the other treaties. Occasionally, a government official from one of the participating countries will find something so egregious that they'll put it on WikiLeaks, and we can get a look at one chapter. That has not been happening with TISA. They've locked that one down, so we have not been able to work as hard on that one. So what do these agreements have to do with tobacco regulation? The main problem with these treaties now is that, for instance, in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there are 29 chapters that we know of. Only five of them deal with traditional trade issues, such as tariffs, border, non-tariff barriers to trade. The other chapters all deal with regulations. So they've been called anti-regulation treaties. They've also been called preemption at the global level, because once you have these in place, it becomes almost impossible for a government to regulate on particular issues, lest they be sued for sometimes hundreds of billions of dollars, which is the case with Australia, which I'll talk about in a moment. And I also want to make sure it's clear that even though it's the federal government that negotiates these treaties, they do apply to state and local governments. So regulations passed at the local level are still subject to the rules of these treaties, even when you haven't read them. And some of these texts aren't even made public until 4 years after they come into force. So you'll be subject to it and not even know it. So there are five problem chapters inside the Trans-Pacific Partnership that we know of. I'm going to focus a lot of my attention on the investment chapter, and this is something called investment state dispute settlement that is the biggest problem that we've had in the world on tobacco control lately. This allows corporations to directly sue governments for regulations that they feel have impacted their profits. So in the case of the World Trade Organization, and you may have heard about the cloves case a couple of years ago after the U.S. banned flavorings except for menthol, and we lost that case in the WTO. That was brought by Indonesia, the government, because in the WTO rules, only a government can sue another government over these regulations. What this investment chapter does is allow Philip Morris to take that case directly against a foreign government without having to get that government champion to move forward. And they've been using that under other investment chapters and other treaties to their heart's content for several years. So like NAFTA, which also was one of the first agreements to have ISDS, TPP and TTIP do have ISDS in their draft documents. It looks like they will survive in both. There have been some arguments about it, but it looks like it will be, and certainly in the TPP. So one of the things we've been trying to do is get tobacco taken out of it, so that they can't use this battering ram against us. Some of you may have heard of something called forum shopping in legal circles, when a plaintiff will look around for the best court to take a case to hear their side of it. This is a bit like forum shopping, except that they don't have to choose. This just gives them an additional forum to go to. So we'll talk about Australia in a minute, but it gives Philip Morris one more place to go if they can't win anywhere else, and they only have to win once, and as we'll talk about in a moment, they don't even really need to win at all to get what they want out of these treaties. Intellectual property is one of the main issues with tobacco control, one of the main frictions between tobacco control and international trade, and as I said earlier, this goes way beyond tobacco. This goes for any public health issue. So let's talk about Australia a bit. This is one of the poster childs for the friction between tobacco control and trade. Australia has been one of the champions in the last 10 years for tobacco control in the world. They were one of the first countries to ratify the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, the WHO treaty, and they have almost fully implemented it. And one of the things that they did, and that the treaty obligates countries to do, is to completely ban marketing for tobacco. And they realized about 3 years ago that the last place that the industry is able to market its products is on the pack itself. So they already had large graphic warning labels like we saw earlier, but they wanted to go further, and they instituted plain packaging, which means that there's the word Marlboro appears in a standard font on a standard drab background, and then 80% of the rest of the pack is a graphic warning label. And it basically takes away the branding that the tobacco industry can use. Philip Morris did not like this very much. They sued them domestically, and that went all the way to their Supreme Court, where Philip Morris lost. They're suing them in the WTO. They've managed to find five different countries, including a couple that don't even trade in tobacco with Australia, to sue them under WTO rules. And then they have found an obscure bilateral investment treaty between Australia and Hong Kong, quickly purchased a piece of another company in Australia so that they would qualify as an investor under that agreement, and then are suing them there. So to Australia's credit, they have not backed down. They've said, bring it on. We've got all of our legal ducks in a row, and we know we can win this case. Our worry, of course, is that other countries might not have the wherewithal to do that. Australia is a rich nation, but the tobacco treaty, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, has 179 parties. And a lot of those parties do not have the same amount of money. These cases typically take about $8 million apiece, win or lose. And when you're being sued several times, that starts to add up. As an example, at a similar time that Australia passed its plain packaging law, the country of Uruguay passed some new stringent packaging requirements that basically took away Marlboro's ability to undermine the no light, no low, no mild descriptors by using colors. So they have Marlboro Red, Marlboro Green, Marlboro Blue. And so Uruguay said, you can't do that anymore. Every brand gets one presentation, and that's all you can. Then they have big warning labels as well. So they're being sued by Philip Morris under another bilateral investment treaty, and they don't have the money to defend themselves. Fortunately, then Mayor Bloomberg stepped forward and funded their defense. He can't do that for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so what the industry wants here, they don't really care if they win. If they win, that's great. What they want to do is convince countries like Paraguay next door that they can't institute similar packaging laws because they can't afford the $8 million to defend it, win or lose. In terms of the regulatory chill as well, because of these cases that have gone on, countries that have considered plain packaging have backed down. New Zealand was on track to follow Australia a year later. They put it on hold to see how Australia wins. And you can go all the way back in the 1990s. Canada was the first country to propose plain packaging. And because of a threatened lawsuit by Philip Morris under NAFTA, they backed down. And that's Canada, another rich country. And New Zealand, of course, is not poor either. I'll quickly run through some of the other areas where tobacco regulations can be impacted by trade agreements. One is cross-border services, and we're used to thinking of trade as trading things, but more and more trade is about trade and services. And services can be distribution, it can be marketing, it can be a lot of different things, even transportation. So any regulation that impacts any of these, such as internet sales bans, are ripe for lawsuit under these trade agreements. I won't go into this. This is a lot of legalese. but it goes back to these services and a lot of the different ways that we're as the tobacco control community moves forward with more and more cutting edge activities to block the industry's ability to push its product. There's going to be pushback from these trade agreements, especially if the industry is at the table and public health is not. So state and local laws, as I said before, are certainly vulnerable to it. The prohibition of any product is considered under trade rules to be a quota of zero, and so they are also ripe for lawsuits. And of course, there's a lot of U.S. states that would balk at an $8 million price tag, and don't expect that the federal government is going to come to your aid and pay for your defense just because they negotiated the treaty that you're getting sued under. I'll leave this slide on there, but it's I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to pass through it. This is more legalese on trade agreements. Of course, as you know, as everyone in here must know, the way that we move forward on tobacco control in this country is at the state level. The states lead the way, and that's one of the reasons that we've been focusing on frictions between trade agreements and state rules. It goes way beyond public health. A lot of the rules regulations that deal with tobacco control are not done by the commissioners of health. They're done by other levels of government. Retail tobacco placement is a big deal. That's a service. That's distribution, and those are ripe for lawsuits. Vending machines is a way of one of the methods of distribution. Also going to fall under a lot of these trade agreements, in particular the TPP. Tobacco samples, another example where a state might be ripe for a lawsuit if they pass a ban or a limit tobacco samples. And this is just a quick. Not popping up. There we go. Let me just get all through here. This was some of the research that the Harrison Institute of Georgetown did for us, and this was very preliminary. They only looked at these three areas. And so these are the laws that exist in the states that if the TPP is passed, could be ripe for a lawsuit. And by the way, it applies to existing laws as well as future laws. So just because you've already passed it does not mean you're safe. So what do we do about this? What we've been working on is a carve-out in the TPP, and by carve-out I mean an exemption. I mean language at the end of the treaty that says nothing in this treaty applies to tobacco measures. And that would make sure that we don't have to worry about litigating whether or not an exception for tobacco applies to a given chapter. It wouldn't apply to any of the chapters. And a lot of rights and privileges go to corporations under these treaties. If we can carve out tobacco, then we can at least solve that issue. We can also do exceptions and exclusions for other public health measures if we can win this battle on tobacco. So I think I'm running very low on time. There have been a number of proposals on tobacco. I think the takeaway message is that for the first time in trade relation history, we've managed to get tobacco on the agenda, and they have been arguing about it. And the biggest thing that we've had happen is that Malaysia in 2013 did propose a full carve-out for tobacco, which is completely unprecedented in trade negotiation history. So it's at least in the press. It's being discussed, and the last we heard, and that's the last bullet point here, it's becoming an open secret if you just Google it. The U.S. seems to be ready to propose at least a carve-out for the investment state dispute settlement chapter, which would mean that Philip Morris cannot sue directly against government regulations. We've gotten the conversation in this country. We have almost full agreement amongst the public health community that a carve-out is the way to go in these treaties, that there's no reason for the U.S. to give up its right to regulate tobacco just to get these trade agreements. In addition to the public health and medical associations, I wanted to point out that the National Association of Attorneys General in January circulated a letter amongst themselves calling for the United States to support Malaysia's carve-out proposal. 45 AGs signed that letter. And I talked to somebody at the NAG National Office, and they said they can't agree on lunch to that level. In the 30 years that this one guy has been at NAG, he doesn't remember a single issue that 45 AGs have agreed on. And so that's the people that know the most about what state regulations are at threat, and it's whose job it will be to defend their regulations if they get sued. And they all agree, or almost all of them agree, that we need to carve this out. I'll skip this one as well. The states have started to get involved, and they should get involved. They should be working not only as state government, but getting their national representatives to make their voice heard in Congress and with the White House. And 2015 is a pivotal year. TPP is probably going to be finished in that year. They're working through the last political hurdles to get it finished. And this is the time to act. Get. I know there are people here that are in government. There are people here that have the government's ear at the state and local level. Make your voices heard. Vermont and Maine already have. If you'd like to know how, get some sample template letters to send. Come to me, and I'll be happy to share it with you. As I said, we have copious amounts of information. I should have put my information on here, too, but if you want, you can come up and see me afterwards. Thank you so much.